We want to continue our study of the book of Philippians this morning. And in our previous study last Sunday, we covered verses 1 through 11 of chapter 2. And in that lesson, and in that section of the epistle, we noted that the Apostle Paul makes an appeal to these brethren that they strive for unity with one another, that they be of one mind. And he goes on to tell them that they must, each of them must have this humble attitude, this lowliness of mind that is not self-seeking but is concerned for the welfare of others. Not merely looking out for your own interests but also the interests of others. And then he points them to Jesus as that perfect example of this virtue of humility, of this self-emptying mindset and doing what is necessary for others, even at personal cost, personal sacrifice. And so that's what we looked at last week. And so now we come to verse 12, and he says, "Therefore, my beloved," and again, this word "therefore" is a word that signals to us that there's a connection between what he's already said to what he's about to say. He's now making an application or giving another appeal to them based on what he said. This is what you need to do. Well, this is what I hope that you'll do. And he tells them that not just in my presence, but now much more in my absence. Work out your salvation with fear and trembling. I've appealed to you as brethren. I've urged you to be of one mind and to be humble towards one another. And in light of what he said, in light of this wonderful example that we have in Christ, of this humility, now's the time to take action. You need to apply what I've said, and you need to obey what I've said. And you need to do that not just as you have done in my presence, but even more that I'm now not present with you. In my absence, you need to obey and apply this teaching, working out your salvation with fear and trembling. You know, the true test of our character as Christians is our willingness to obey God when we're not in the presence of other Christians. You know, how we act here in the assembly when we are with one another should be the way we act all the time. Mm-hmm. That when we walk through those doors, you know, we put on a mask or a disguise. We take on the role of being a Christian. But when we leave and we go back into the world, you know, we, our true persona, our true personality, our true person or self comes out. And we're just like the world. I remember when I was a student at Florida College, being shocked to hear that some students had gotten into trouble for things like drinking and fornication and other things. These were things that I'd heard about from my classmates in high school that I expected, that was not a shock to me. But to go to a place where presumably we were all Christians and devoted to the Lord, and to hear that there were some students getting into trouble for those things, it was quite a shock to me. And some of these kids were children of preachers and elders. And here they were in a place far from home, no longer under the watchful eye of their parents, and they were not behaving as they had done when they were home. They were now getting into trouble. you know, what we do together should be how we are all the time. To be obedient to God, not just on Sundays, but Monday through Saturday as well. But there's something else here that I will point out to you in this introduction. From what Paul says here in verse 12, this appeal that he makes to fear God, or to work out your salvation with fear and trembling. And that is that each of us needs to take personal responsibility for our salvation. You know, all of us have become Christians through the teaching of others. Others have helped to lead us to Christ. It may have been our parents. If we were fortunate enough to have parents who were Christians, who taught us from an early age the Bible and raised us up in the nurture and admonition of the Lord, they're the primary teachers that we had that have helped us to grow up and become Christians. Or it could be some other, just a Christian in general, someone that you met later in life who led you to Christ. It may have been through some preacher, or through an elder, or through a Bible class teacher, or whatever. We all owe a debt of gratitude to someone, and probably many people, for helping us come to Christ and to come to a better knowledge of Christ and to develop and to grow in our faith. And we should always be grateful to them. But we cannot be entirely dependent upon them to carry us to heaven. We have to take personal responsibility for ourselves and take from them what we've learned from the Scriptures and use that in our lives to bear fruit. It's discouraging, it's distressing, it's sad to see some who never seem to make any spiritual progress, who are for always falling back or falling away and coming back and then falling away again, who seem to struggle all the time to make any advancement in their spiritual lives. And it may be that they're relying upon others to carry them. Perhaps those that have led them to Christ or have taught them the gospel to motivate them and to encourage them. And they seem to do well if those people are present. But when those people aren't present is when they fall back and struggle spiritually. When they can't seem to function or get along. And I'm not saying that we don't need encouragement. We do need encouragement. And we do need support and help. But this appeal of Paul to these brethren and to us, it is a call to take personal responsibility for salvation. We need to understand that I can't do it for you, and you can't do it for me. We can help each other. We can encourage one another. And we can bear one another's burdens. But ultimately, the responsibility for my salvation rests on me. And yours rests on you. And if on Judgment Day you are cast out by the Lord and you're lost, the fault and the blame will lie on you, and solely you. And you won't be able to say to the Lord, well, I just didn't get enough encouragement from the brethren. I didn't get enough help. The Lord will not accept that as an excuse. And so we need to take personal responsibility. And in this text, I want to point out to you, I think, four actions that we need to take as we work out our salvation. And the first one is this, that it requires our cooperation with God. We need to understand that although we must take personal responsibility for our salvation, we're not doing it alone. That God is working in us for His good pleasure. And therefore we need to cooperate with Him by listening to Him and what He's said in His Word and obeying His Word. He says to them, "Work out your salvation with fear and trembling, for it is God who is at work in you, both to will and to work for His good pleasure." God is at work in us, He says. And therefore we, because God is at work in us, we need to work with Him. We need to do the work He's given us to do, developing ourselves personally, individually, and also helping others and encouraging others. Striving for that unity that the Apostle Paul appeals for us to have. Having that one mind, that same love, and that humble attitude that puts others ahead of self and seeks others' best interests and makes sacrifices for those people. Salvation is a process. I think we can see that from this commandment when he says, "Work out your salvation." It's a process. It's a lifetime calling or vocation. It's like a novel. You know, salvation, it's like a novel. It has a beginning, a middle, and an ending. And in 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, in verses 13 through 15, I think we see that. Paul says in 2 Thessalonians 2, verses 13 through 15, "But we are bound to give thanks to God always for you, brethren, beloved by the Lord, because God from the beginning chose you for salvation through sanctification by the Spirit and belief in the truth, to which He called you by our gospel for the obtaining of the glory of our Lord Jesus Christ. Therefore, brethren, stand fast and hold the traditions which you were taught, whether by word or our epistle." And so here we can see that salvation has a beginning, a middle, and an ending. The beginning, of course, is when God called us through the gospel and saved us through sanctification by the Spirit and belief in the truth. The ending is that we might obtain the glory of our Lord Jesus Christ, that we would be raised unto life eternal and be clothed with immortality and be given a body, a glorious body like His glorious body. But the middle is stated in verse 15. "Therefore, brethren, stand fast and hold the traditions which you were taught, whether by word or by our epistle." And so that is the task that we've been called to do, to work out, is to do what's necessary in the middle between the time when God called us and chose us and the ending, the glory that He has purposed for us to have. It's the middle where we're called upon to work out. And I don't know if you've ever read a novel and got into the middle of it and became bored with it because the plot was too thick or the characters were uninteresting or it just kind of got bogged down and it was a chore just to read one page. and in exasperation you throw the book out and you never finish it because you don't even care how it ends because the middle is so boring or uninteresting. And that's usually what makes or breaks a good book, is the middle. You know, the beginning, it starts off and it's exciting and you get introduced into the story and the characters and you get through the first few chapters and then you get into the heart of the book where the plot works itself out, and that's really what makes or breaks a good book and makes you finish it. And spiritually speaking, that's what will make or break us, is what we do in the middle. Things can get muddled for us spiritually in the middle. And there are different things that can happen to us. Of course, we should never forget that we have an adversary. We have an enemy who is bent on our spiritual destruction, the devil. And he's doing whatever he can to put obstacles in our path or to entice us, to draw us away from God. And Jesus warned, for example, that when he told the parable of the sower and he explained the meaning of the thorns, he said the cares of this world, the deceitfulness of riches, choke out the word and it becomes unfruitful. And so that might be one way that the devil would use to mess things up for you. Or it could be the weights, the temptations, that those old sins that continue to come back and weigh us down and entangle us and ensnare us all over again. The Hebrew writer in Hebrews 12 verse 1 tells us that we need to lay aside every weight and the sin which so easily ensnares us, and let us run with endurance the race that is set before us. And it could be that's how the devil gets to us. And for some Christians, that's what you see. They get entangled again in those old sins, those things that once had them in the grip, that they were able to free themselves for a while, but now they're in its clutches again. They're ensnared again. They just can't drop those weights and those things that would slow them down and keep them from really making any progress or spiritual growth. Or it could be false teaching that he uses to hinder us. In Paul's letter to the Galatians, he wrote to them and he told them how amazed he was and how astonished he was that they had so quickly turned away from the gospel that he proclaimed for another gospel. And those teachers who were teaching them to be circumcised and to observe the law, they had turned aside from the gospel that Paul had proclaimed to them and had become slaves once again. They had been enslaved again. And he said to them in chapter 5 and verse 7, "You ran well. You ran well. Who hindered you from obeying the truth?" And so it could be false teachers that hinder us from obeying the truth. But whatever it is, we need to understand that salvation is a process that has a beginning, a middle, and an ending. And for us to get to that glorious ending, that glorious outcome, we need to take care of things properly now, in the middle, in the fight, working out our salvation. And so that's the first thing, that it requires our cooperation with God. The second thing that it requires is that we obey with the proper attitude. Paul says here that we are to work out your salvation with fear and trembling. Work out your salvation with fear and trembling. What does that mean? Well, let me ask you a question. On what level do we fear God? On what level do we fear God? Is it merely the fear of punishment? Is it merely the fear of judgment? That form of fear is rooted in self-love, self-preservation. And it's really a sign of immaturity. Now, we should fear God on that level. I'm not denying that. We're told, for instance, in Hebrews that it's a terrifying thing to fall into the hands of the living God. And we certainly see many examples that illustrate God's wrath and God's judgment, even upon His own people who sinned and rebelled against Him. So I'm not saying you shouldn't fear God on that basis. But our fear of Him should be more than just terror or fright or fear of punishment. And our only motivation for doing what's right is to avoid going to hell. I would hope that we would desire to obey God from a much higher motive than just that. As I said, fear of punishment is really rooted in self-love, self-preservation. And when I was a little kid, and I'd be home with my mother, and if I started to misbehave or to act up, she would say to me, "You better straighten out. You better behave yourself. Otherwise, when your father comes home, you're going to get a spanking." And sometimes that threat worked. And sometimes it didn't. But when it did work, my only reason for behaving and obeying my mother was so that I wouldn't get a spanking when my dad came home. I was trying to avoid the punishment, you see. And, you know, being a little kid, being 3 or 4 years old, you know, that's really the only way my mother could reach me. Because I wasn't mature enough or old enough to understand that I should obey my parents because they're my parents. And because they love me and desire the best in me and know what's best for me and understand what's right and what's wrong and what's good and bad and what's appropriate and what's not. And that I should trust them, knowing that they love me, that they wouldn't try to deceive me or lie to me, and that I should do what they said. I wasn't old enough at that point to really conceptualize that or understand that. And so what I'm saying to you is that it's a mark of spiritual infancy to merely be motivated to do what God says merely because you want to avoid the punishment of hell. I think God desires more from us than just that. That we should fear Him, not rooted in love of self, but rooted in love for Him. Out of respect and regard for Him, because He is God. And He is holy. I think Joseph is a good illustration of what I'm trying to say. You remember in Genesis chapter 39 when Potiphar's wife came to him and tried to seduce him to sleep with her. And he said, "There is no one greater in this house than I, nor has he, that is Potiphar, my master, your husband, kept back anything from me but you, because you are his wife." And then note what he said. "How then can I do this great wickedness and sin against God. Joseph was shocked and horrified at the thought of committing adultery because it was a sin against God. He had too much love and respect for God to indulge himself, to do this wicked thing. And that's what I think Paul is getting at here when he says, work out your salvation with fear and trembling. It's not that he wants us just to be shaking in our boots all the time, so to speak, at the thought of God having the power to save us or destroy us in hell. Sometimes that motivation works. There was a famous lesson, and I forget who preached it. You've probably heard the title, Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God. And sometimes that motivation works. But God wants us to grow up to respect Him and to fear Him in the sense that we love Him because He is God, and that we obey Him out of that sense of love and respect for Him. 1 John chapter 4, verse 18 says, there is no fear in love, but perfect love casts out fear, because fear involves torment. But he who fears has not been made perfect in love. God desires for us to grow up and be perfected in love. And that, when we have that perfect love, it casts out fear. We no longer serve God out of fear of punishment or what He'll do to us if we don't do what's right. But we serve Him because of that love for Him, because He is God. And so that's something that we certainly need to be working on as we work out our salvation. But he also says, do nothing from complaining or disputing. Verse 14, do all things without complaining or disputing. And so, still talking about the attitude that we ought to have in obeying God. We should, on the positive side, he says, with fear and trembling. But on the negative side, do all things without complaining or disputing. You know, we may obey God, but if we're complaining about what God would have us to do, then we're not pleasing Him. He says that you might be blameless and innocent, above reproach, in the midst of a crooked and perverse generation. And we're not blameless or above reproach before God if in our obedience we're always complaining and grumbling what God has told us to do. That was Israel's problem. And that was their downfall. When they were being led by Moses to the promised land, they were constantly complaining and grumbling. Complaining that they didn't have water. Complaining that they didn't have meat. Complaining that, you know, they've been dragged out into the wilderness to die. Complaining that, you know, Moses wasn't doing what he needed to do, or he was taking too long up on the mountain. Just complaining, 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 complaining. And complaining leads to disputing. If you're upset with someone, if you disagree with what someone's doing, how they're leading, and you're complaining about them all the time, eventually you're going to dispute and argue with them. And that's what Israel began to do. They began disputing and arguing with Moses. And at one point, there was a faction among them who led a rebellion, a revolt, to depose him and to take over and to lead the people back to Egypt. And so, that's a very bad example to follow. To be grumbling and complaining all the time. I'll tell you another story from my childhood. You're going to get the impression I was a bad kid. You know, we had a wood stove in the house that helped to heat the house in the wintertime. And it was my job and my brother's job to carry in the wood, which I hated to do. But that was my job. Well, that was our job. Carry in the wood, fill up the box so that we have wood to put into the stove during the night. Now, I did it. I obeyed my father, carried the wood, but I was complaining, I was grumbling the whole time I was doing it. Because I was outside in the cold, I wanted to be in my room, I wanted to do what I wanted to do, I wanted to play with my toys, I did not want to be out here carrying in this wood. I obeyed, but I certainly didn't obey in the right attitude. And that's what God doesn't want us to do. The third thing he says here, the third action that we need to take, is that we need to hold fast to the word of life. Verse 16, holding fast the word of life, so that in the day of Christ I will have reason to glory, because I did not run or labor in vain. This is an exhortation, an encouragement, word of encouragement that we see running throughout the Bible. Jesus, for example, said, "If you abide in my word, you are my disciples indeed." Paul and Barnabas, as they went about preaching the gospel on their first missionary journey together, when they had established churches, they persuaded them to continue in the grace of God, Acts 13:43. As they returned through those places in Acts 14:22, it says, strengthening the souls of the disciples and exhorting them to continue in the faith. Paul, in some of his letters, gives the same admonition, same exhortation. 1 Corinthians 15:2, by which, that is the gospel, you are saved if you hold fast that word which I preach to you. And again in Colossians 1:23, if indeed you continue in the faith, grounded and steadfast. It's an oft-repeated exhortation in Hebrews. Hebrews 3:6, but Christ is the Son over His own house, whose house we are, if we hold fast the confidence and the rejoicing of the hope firm to the end. Verse 14, we have become partakers of Christ if we hold the beginning of our confidence steadfast to the end. In chapter 4:14, seeing then we have a great high priest who has passed through the heavens, Jesus the Son of God, let us hold fast our confession. And again in chapter 10:23, let us hold fast the confession of our hope without wavering, for he who promised is faithful. And so again and again and again we see this admonition, this exhortation to hold fast that word of life that we've been given. Now Jesus put it this way in Matthew 7:24-25, when he finished his Sermon on the Mount. And he said that if you hear these words of mine and if you do them, I will liken him to a wise man who built his house on the rock. The word is the foundation. We have to build on that. And we have to stand on that if we're to work out our salvation with fear and trembling. It is the rule of faith by which we have to walk continually. And then finally and fourthly, a fourth action that we need to take. Working out our salvation, it requires that we rejoice in our sacrifices. And so we come back again to this theme of joy. Paul was hopeful and optimistic, and he expresses this optimism earlier in the letter that he would eventually be released, and that he would be reunited with these brethren and have the joy of being together again. But he concedes here that there is that prospect that he could die for his faith, that he could be executed. He says, but even if I am being poured out as a drink offering upon the sacrifice and service of your faith, I rejoice and share my joy with you all. You too, I urge you, rejoice in the same way and share your joy with me. Paul was not gloomy or despondent or discouraged that he might die. If giving his life in the service of their faith was what God called him to do, he was happy to do it. He rejoiced that he could die for the brethren, which I suppose probably brought to mind Jesus dying for us, that he could follow in that same path. He rejoiced and he shared that joy. He didn't bottle it up in himself. He shared it. He expressed it. And he said, you rejoice with me and share your joy with me. Now that's an extreme sacrifice. And I don't think as Christians we should have a martyr complex and hope that the authorities come in and drag us off and execute us one by one. But we should be willing to make whatever sacrifices are necessary for the cause of Jesus Christ, our Savior, who gave up everything. And we should rejoice that we are called upon to make those sacrifices. We certainly have to make some sacrifices. Christianity involves making sacrifices. We're to deny self and take up the cross and follow Christ. We're to present our bodies as living sacrifices. Romans 12, verse 1. We're to offer up to God the fruit of our lips with thanksgiving and do good and share with others. For such sacrifices, God is well pleased. So there certainly are some sacrifices that we're called on to make. And these sacrifices we may do in service to our own faith or in service to others' faith. And it could be time, it could be money, it could be many things. It could be our lives. But whatever it is, it's for a good cause. It's in service to others and to the building up their faith, to the salvation of their souls. And that's always a reason to rejoice. This is how Paul viewed his possible execution. He was ready to die and give his life in service to others, because the preserving of his own life was not what made him happy. It was saving other people. It was helping other people on the road to heaven. He said time and time again that the disciples were his joy and crown. For example, 1 Thessalonians 2 and verse 19. And Paul was always concerned for brethren that he had labored in vain. He expresses that here. He was concerned that on the day of judgment, they wouldn't be saved. That he could not boast about them on that day because they had fallen short. And he was afraid he had labored in vain on their case. That was what Paul was willing to do. And the question is, what are we willing to do for Jesus, for the building up of the church, and for reaching out to the lost? And what sacrifices are we willing to make for that to happen? And do we rejoice when we have that opportunity to make those sacrifices? Helping others come to Christ and receive a heavenly reward makes any sacrifice worthwhile. And it constitutes a good reason to rejoice. So these are some actions that we need to take to work out our salvation. To cooperate with God who's at work in us. To obey Him with fear and trembling, not with complaining and disputing. To hold fast to the word of life. That's the foundation. That's the standard. And to rejoice in the sacrifices that God calls on us to make. And so may God help us to do these things. To do these things with fear and trembling. Salvation is a free gift. But we must obey God to receive it. Will you obey Him today? I talked about salvation having a beginning, a middle, and an end. For you, if you're not a Christian, then the beginning is still waiting to happen. And if you need to come to Jesus today, we want to invite you to come to Him in obedience. To begin working with Him and letting Him work through you. To work out your salvation so that your life will end in glory. That your life will be saved on that terrible day when God comes again in judgment on the wicked, but in salvation for those who are His. So if you need to come to God and obey Him today, we urge you to do so as we stand and as we sing.